Are you ready? Are you set for some podcast magic?
Yeah, I think I am. Yeah.
All right.
So many,
So
so
many.
many damn books.
Hello to the listeners out there in podcast land. My name is Christopher. This is So Many Damn Books, a blessing, a curse, a podcast. I am so excited to be joined today by Christine Grillo. Christine is a writer and editor. Her nonfiction appears in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Audubon, and more. Her short fiction has been published in Story Quarterly, The Southern Review, and LIT, and other places. And she's here to discuss her incendiary, new novel, Hestia Strikes a Match. This is an incredible book. I'm so excited to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I just love the format of this. This is really fun. I mean, drinking while talking about books.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, I had so much fun coming up with the cocktail inspired by your book. So I'm calling the drink Tea Party Redux because so this book is set in an alternate 2023 where a second civil war has erupted and states have seceded. And so I was thinking about, and there is a also a second Tea Party depicted in the book, which I absolutely loved and thought was very funny and also sad and too
Yeah.
believable, like so much of the book. And it got me wondering what tea was actually thrown into the harbor back at the original Tea Party. And so I
Right.
looked this up. And it was three types of black tea and two types of green tea. So I took a black tea and I love making tea syrups. I've done them for a lot of different cocktails already. So a black tea syrup, I used a Souchong black tea because that was one of the teas that they threw into the harbor.
Ooh, I love Souchong.
So
That's
it's got that nice
good.
smokiness of a Souchong.
Yeah.
The rest is bourbon, Kentucky bourbon, because that you know the I'm trying to bring the country together with this
You're
drink.
hitting all the notes.
Then limoncello, some lemon juice, fresh juice always, and then peach jam. And you shake all this up and double strain it. And it makes a really lovely drink. And if you have single or Hyson green tea at home, that was the green tea that they threw into the harbor. So you could make a green tea version of this if you wanted, and it would ha ex achieve the same effect. I love these sort of bourbon jam cocktails, and but I think it's still tart with the lemon juice.
Yeah, when I saw your recipe, I thought, peach jam, this guy's like really, this is out there.
A jam jar cocktail is one of my absolute favorite ways to when you're d finished with a jam jar. When you're all the way scraped and there's just like some left on the sides of the, that is when you put, half an ounce of lemon juice, 2 ounces of your favorite liquor, and just shake that up. And you throw some ice in there, you've got a cocktail. Plus, you
That's
can take it
pretty
wherever you
cool.
want to go. Just put it in your bag, put the jam jar right back on top.
Oh, that is really smart.
Go
Well,
catch a sunset.
yeah, I was not able to make a black tea syrup, but
Okay.
I did pour some bourbon in a cup and add some lemon and some brown sugar, and I plucked some mint, which I very
Oh,
inelegantly muddled and put that in there. So that's pretty good.
that's fantastic. I'm so glad you're joining me. That's lovely to hear.
It's not peach jam level, but we're trying with what we've got.
I used to only do this show with in-person guests, and it made more sense to put where I would serve the cocktail to them. And as we moved into this new format, I have tried to simplify, but I just had so much fun putting this together and thought like peach jam in particular would go so well with the limoncello and the bourbon. I don't know. I had a
No,
good time.
I loved the tea party idea because that was such a fun scene for me to write. And I just love that you picked up on the tea.
So that is the cocktail. I'm so excited to talk to you about your book, but before we get there, I like to warm up the book talk, talking what did you buy? bought any books recently? Has anything been sent to you that you're really excited to check out? Or have you bought anything? You know, this is a whole celebration of consumerism. It can be anything you've bought at all.
Well, I'll start with books. I have recently, so I'm a big audiobook person and I love to listen to books. I do my stupid health walks around the neighborhood every day and it's just so much less irritating, you know, to have that routine if I have a good book to listen to. So I have recently, I'm listening now to Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton, which I love. And one of the things I love about audiobooks is when it's a book that's not American, you get the accents.
Yes.
And so that New Zealand accent is so much fun. I love listening to that. And
I remember listening to The Luminaries, her last novel, which I never would have. I don't think I ever would have actually read that book. It was just so hefty and there were so many parts to it. But having it read to me and different people doing the voices, luscious, so much fun.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to hear that the new book is also good on audio.
It's really good. And I just love the whole guerrilla gardening. I'm really, you know, I have fantasies about taking over. I live in the city of Baltimore and I have fantasies about taking over these lots. Like I sort of drive slowly by the vacant lots about the things that I could plant there. So I'm very keen on the guerrilla gardening. Yeah, before that, I bought Eleanor Oliphant is Fine, which is another great one for accents. There's so many Scottish accents, and it's not just Scottish, it's just Glaswegian, which is like the most Scottish of the Scottish accents.
I listened to that too. The Gail Honeyman book. What a great novel, and truly, it's such a performance. You know, it really is such like a, and so. I really like a first person or like a very close third novel that is told like that. It's very satisfying.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be all literary and talk about the writing technique. And I'm just like, I love the accent. I've also bought a really awesome pair of gardening gloves that go like above my elbow and they're kind of suede. And so that feels very good. I like that a lot.
You can really get into the soil with that.
Yeah, and you can really be protected from a lot of things like sun and poison ivy. And yeah, so along with that, so this is the time of year also to get a new pair of clippers, you know, garden shears, and a knife. I have a gardening knife, a hori-hori. It's a Japanese knife. It's just the best. Yeah, it's like serrated on one edge. Yeah.
Upgrading your garden tools, that seems like a very springy thing to do. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. I love tools.
Well, I got a couple of things in the mail I picked up too that I'm very excited about. First of all, the new Paul Murray novel comes out in August. Mm-hmm. I absolutely... Skippy Dies is one of my five favorite books ever written. Have you read his piece on the New York Mag about the metaverse? Like he did this fantastic, like it felt like old school magazine journalism where he just spent weeks and weeks talking to people inside the metaverse, trying to figure out like who's using this and why. I highly recommend it. It's very, very funny. And it also just speaks to how much of an enormous failure it is. So there's some nice Schadenfreude to be had.
Schadenfreude's pretty delicious.
Yeah. So I recommend checking out that that piece. I'll link to it on the episode page so you can get to it. But yeah, I was so excited when this huge, hefty, it's like 650 pages. And then I also got The Lost Journals of Sacagawea by Deborah Magpie Earling.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited about this. It's out from Milkweed Editions. And it's a fictional account of her life. And I'm just particularly excited as someone who loves the Lewis and Clark Expedition. I really, really want to hear someone have her side of what it was like to be with them. And I know that's only a small part of the book. I know it covers her entire life. So I'm really, really excited to check it out. Very interestingly told. I'm already just like flipping through. You can see that she's playing with language in a really exciting way.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's a great recommendation. I will probably check out both of those. I had, when I was young, I grew up near Richmond, Virginia, and I had this fantasy at some point that I would write about Motoka, Pocahontas. And I just, you know, the disservice done by all the stories told about her, that I'm not the person to write that book. So I'm glad that she wrote the Sacagawea.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm excited about that too. Your novel, Hestia Strikes a Match. It's was such a, I didn't know anything about it going in. It was truly like just off the stack and started reading it, which is a fantastic way to encounter a book like this. And I was just immediately sucked in. Can you please tell the listeners a little bit the synopsis of the book?
Sure. It's set now in 2023. We've just officially begun our second American Civil War. And the main character, Hestia Harris, is in her early 40s, and she's just been abandoned by her husband, who has left to go fight for the United States of America against the new Confederacy. And so a lot of the book, so the Civil War is actually the kind of a backdrop for the book. And I would say the bulk of the book is about Hestia, who's a pretty immature 40-something trying to figure out what to do about her loneliness, how to make friends, how to go on dates, how to connect with people and create a community. And being as she's kind of her own worst enemy, she makes it more difficult than it has to be. But I think she finds a way. And
I mean, it's something that I was really connecting to right away, is that even for this horrible, violent backdrop, from page one, it feels like there's like a seeking of joy. You know, there's, she's really like, it's not a doldrums book in the same way that, like, it turns out that living through a pandemic, there's other stuff that you do and you find silver linings all the time. But I just think still, like, living in the fictional world of your second Civil War for the duration of writing a novel, how does it feel to be experiencing that, walking around in that sort of particular authorly haze?
Yeah. Well, it was, that haze was really aided and abetted very well by the time, you know, the Trump administration, which is when I was writing the book. And because I think every day we had some pundit somewhere saying, are we in a civil war? Mm-hmm. Are we going to be in a civil war? And so I think that was really on my mind a lot of the time. And I felt like I didn't have to really stretch that hard to create that reality. It was just a little more real than the reality we had. So it was really helpful for me. I tell a lot of people that I think the book was therapy for me, because I started off feeling just like disappointed in my fellow Americans and heartbroken and disenchanted with democracy and wanting to write about that. And at some point I was like, wow, I really don't want to write a depressing book about how doomed we are. So I turned to some satire and some humor, and I think in the end I just felt like, well, if we do go to civil war, like, we still have to make dinner and go to work and mow the lawn, you know, and like the people who are funny when you're not in a war are the same people who are funny when you're in a war, and everybody's still looking for love and friends. And
yeah, I mean, it was such a compelling, I don't know, bifurcation of the timeline to be in. And I'd love to know a little bit more about how you went about creating this second Civil War and these conditions. Was it something that you were finding as the chapters went, or did you start with all of the concepts and sort of figuring out the reality before you were figuring out what Hestia was going to experience of it?
Yeah. I would like to say that I'm the kind of writer who writes the 7-page world building document first, but I'm really more like the writer who almost finishes a novel and then says, wow, I need to really figure out what this world is. And then I sort of went back. So I had created a bunch of chapters and scenes. The book is 7 chapters, and each chapter is a different boyfriend or romantic experience. And so I had written a bunch of those, and I had just the backdrop of the Civil War that I created was just kind of what was on my mind at the time, the, you know, power grid going down, or, you know, pipe bombs in a van. And as I got more and more into the novel, I realized I really need to build this out more thoroughly and cohesively. And that's when I started doing my research and reading up about the first Civil War. And I did go on some Reddit threads. I say very sheepishly, but it turns out there are a lot of people on Reddit who like to theorize about what would happen.
One thing that I think Reddit has going for it is there's a lot of people with very specialized education and special interest that they are applying.
Absolutely. And it's a great place when you're writing fiction, because no one has to be right. It just has to have the whiff of being right. Mm-hmm. So, and then we would look at, look at what's going on in Palestine. You know, what is life like for a Palestinian? I would think back to the troubles in Northern Ireland. What was life like for Northern Irish? And actually the show Dairy Girls, if you've ever seen that, was really helpful for me in just that sort of tone of, you know, for people who don't know the show, it's about these high school girls living in North Ireland and in Londonderry, which they call Derry. And it's like them just trying to live their normal high school girl lives, being the dumbasses that high school girls are. But every now and then, like, there's a bomb scare when they're on their way to a field trip. And so watching that, I was like, that is really the kind of tone that I want. Like, there are people just trying to do their lives, and it's just very inconvenient and sometimes terrifying war that makes everything that much more difficult.
I loved how you used the war to create this sort of funhouse reflection, like recasting dating apps in particular into this new world resonated. Yeah. I mean, I met my partner on a dating app, so I believe in them, but I also can see how horrible they would be in a situation like this. And it is one of my absolute favorite scenes in the book, where someone on a date with her misunderstands how she's casting her relationship with her husband. And thinks that because she's mad at him for leaving her, she's also mad at the union and is not part of it. Yeah. And it's really one of these things that, like, it was just so close. There's just like that little bit of turning it just to the left of how things truly are that made it really poignant and funny and sad.
Yeah. I've told this story a couple of times at readings over the last few weeks. And so what you're talking about is the third chapter. And but for me, I had a similar experience in real life that was really the spark for me of the book. And this was probably in 2018 or 2019. I caught up on the phone. I reconnected with an old friend from back when I lived in New York, and we were so close. We would we worked together, and then we would go out for drinks at Old Town afterwards, and we were just really close. And fell away after I moved to Baltimore, fell out of touch. And so we reconnected on the phone, and very similar to what happens in the book, we were having a nice conversation. And then he said something about sheep. And then he said something about libtard. And, you know, when I tell this story at readings, you can sort of hear the gasp in the audience, because they know where sheep is going and they right. know where libtard is going.
It's a horror movie. It's just like, get out of the house.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just, it's so disorienting. And yeah, so that for me was like, I have to write about this, because this is such a hard thing that we really haven't, in my lifetime, I really haven't had to deal with before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that ideological split. I mean, you feel so betrayed. I felt so betrayed.
Yeah, especially because it can blindside you. Like, everything else can be fine. And there's so many things that it doesn't touch. And it's true that it doesn't touch those things. But then everything gets colored a different shade after that.
Yeah.
Another funhouse reflection was just that Twitter in this world is like truly life-saving. Like, you actually, like, everyone's always saying like, oh, you don't need to read that bad news. But the bad news is like bombings within your like 3 mile radius.
Right.
And so I was thinking about how useful those alerts would be and how real that was. I mean, I think the experience of reading this book reminded me of the experience of reading Severance by Ling Ma,
oh.
where it was just this incredible depiction, very realistic feeling depiction of a pandemic. And it wasn't just the pandemic. There was so many other things that were happening. And there was just like, there was just those little things, like people would be wearing masks that had a Supreme logo on them. And then all of those things came true.
Right.
And now I'm worried, because this is a book that I got all those same sort of feeling like, oh, that is how that would go.
Yeah.
Are you worried that this reality is coming down the pike for us?
I get a little freaked out sometimes, because it does happen. I mean, I finished writing this book probably a year ago. April of last year was really when we had finished up the final edits. And I think it was in June or July that that we learned about the Roe v. Wade development in the Supreme Court. And there was a really big mass shooting, I think in Buffalo, New York, in a grocery store, which mirrored something in the book. And then there was some neo-Nazi plot to bring down the power grid in Baltimore. And all those things happened after I finished the writing of the book. And there were moments where I was like, let's just burn the book. We can't take any chances. But, you know, the fact is, I'm really not that powerful. As much as we all want to have magic powers. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I do worry about it. But it's also, like I said, it's just only a little tiny bit realer than reality. So mm-hmm. I don't have to even be that creative with these scenarios.
That's just what every writer loves to admit. Oh, I wasn't creative at all while I was writing my novel.
I was just really good at keeping notes, which I think a lot of writers, I was a very good note taker. I loved school supplies. That was always the best, right? It's like buying the school supplies in mm-hmm. August. Yeah.
Brand new notebook, brand new pens and everything. It'll be different this year.
Yes.
I mean, I think that the reason why I was particularly thinking about Severance was because I thought that Ling Ma did a great job of this, and you do it as really well too, where you're sort of creating this drama out of what we lack and then what we replace it with and how those, like, how that give and take of the economy, that like is so much starker in conditions like this. And so you can focus in on these little things like bourbon. Like she gets bourbon at one point, and it's this absolutely magical thing.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you bring up that book, because Ling Ma and I share an editor.
So both
our books were acquired by the same person. I'm pretty sure that Jenna acquired Ling's book. So yeah, clearly we know what Jenna likes. but yeah, this idea of like, what is the bare minimum? Like, what is the bare minimum that brings you joy? Because I feel like one of the, you know, humans are so very, very terrible at so many things that are important, like, you know, understanding history and understanding depth and scale and numbers. We're terrible at numbers, but somehow we're super good at adapting. And I think it's the most remarkable thing we do is how we adapt. And I think in Severance, you have those characters adapting to the situation at hand, and not just adapting to it, but like developing their own ecosystem and all the power dynamics within that ecosystem. I really loved that. And so I think about that a lot too. Like you just adapt to whatever is put in front of you. We're so good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Scary. I mean, and maybe that's part of it we have to be bad at history in order to adapt, in order to keep adapting.
Right. Well, and that, I think that adaptability is what has made us such a, such a blight, honestly, such a blight on the planet. It's just really hard to get rid of us.
Well, I don't think we should be gotten rid of just yet. We're still creating some really lovely art. And so that's something to be celebrating. Something that I loved, and I don't know how we haven't talked about this at all yet, when it's an enormous part of the book, but Hestia is working at a retirement village. She has left her job as a reporter into this retirement village. And they were so, these voices that you created and sometimes like got to write within were so distinct and lovely and a great source of comedy in particular. I'd love to hear about creating them and when the retirement village came into the picture.
Yeah. Well, in the novel, Hestia, when the war starts, her beat changes, or her editors want different stories from her, and she doesn't want to write the war stories because it's too depressing. And so she finds this job in a retirement village thinking the Confederates wouldn't bomb old people. Like that would be so it's got to be pretty safe. And they have a really good like surveillance system. And so it feels like a safe place for her to work. And the old people, so there are five elderly characters that we hear from. One of them is Mildred, who is her best friend. And then there are four other characters that we hear from. And I just loved creating them. I love that old people, not all of them, but so many of them lose their filter. Mm-hmm. And that is just my favorite thing about old people. So I feel like they get to say the things that everybody wants to say. And I do a lot of interviewing and for my job, which is working as a science writer. So I interview a lot of academics and scientists. And I don't know if you've ever worked with academics and scientists, but they don't give great quotes. And they tend to sound like robots when they talk. Except for when they're about over 70. Once they hit that threshold, then they just, filter is gone and they just say what they mean. They're not going to hurt or improve their careers at that point. So these characters, well, one of the reviewers referred to them as the Greek chorus. And I was like, oh yeah, that's what I meant all along. They're the Greek chorus. and so they start off in the book explaining how we got here and how the Civil War started and what's going on with it. But as we go throughout the book, they talk more and more about just life, about love and marriage and spirituality and the ego and pain and happiness. And so it was, I think it's sort of a fantasy of mine. I would just love to have five really smart, no filter 80 somethings tell me how to live. Just give me the guidebook, you know?
I love that this is like a realization of a closely held, like a fantasy and of imagination. Like this is something that you actually want for yourself. I thought it was so brilliant to have these writing prompts that Hestia is giving them.
Yeah.
And then you include what they said to the writing prompt. I just think that it was a great form to get these quick shots of truly, it almost reminded me of The Onion. When they have those like three man on the street faces that they've used since the beginning of time, that I would get to hear about, you know, their idea of love or their idea of loss or whatever sort of prompt they were answering. I just thought that was great.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you remember, but sort of around 2018 or so, when I started writing it, all of a sudden I was seeing a lot of ads for, don't know what to get your mom and dad? Get them this living history kit, which would involve a lot of prompts that they could then like speak into a recorder or write down their answers to the prompts. And the commercials were very much centered on these kind of like heteronormative fantasies, I think. And so I started, when I was first creating these characters, I didn't know that I wanted it to be an oral history project per se. But then when I started looking up some of these prompts, and I just felt like, oh God, these are the worst, you know? Like, tell me the happiest moment in your marriage and tell us what you loved most about being a parent. And I just thought there are people who don't have those stories to tell. And so I really wanted, I tried to have that Greek chorus reflect back on, some of us hated our spouses. Some of us.
Well, I mean, I love that they hate the prompt sometimes where they're just like stupid. Like,
They're like, let us write our own prompts.
Part of the reason that it works is because this novel's structure is sort of loose. I mean, in writing class, you learn like your character has to want something.
Yeah.
But Hestia, what she wants is amorphous. She doesn't know what she wants sometimes. And so that is, the creative writing professors would be saying, no, no, no. But all of this is working.
What are the stakes? Yeah.
And yet, like that, there's always something else that pulls you forward. There's like another great interaction with Mildred and the Greek chorus of elderly people, or there's another bizarre comedic date, or there's the fireplace motif, which is one of my favorite things. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it's one of my favorite little returning things in the book.
Yeah. So Hestia is the daughter of two classics professors. And Hestia, of course, is the Greek goddess of the hearth. Vesta is her Roman counterpart. And so I don't make that big a deal about it, but she's living alone in this apartment and she has a non-working fireplace. It's just a mantle. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of people put like televisions in there, but pretty much with every boyfriend, she's like, I know I have to get rid of what's in there and put in something new. So it starts off with just candles. And then she moves into, vases and dried flowers. And then there's pinatas and
birdhouses was a good one,
right? Birdhouses. And so with every boyfriend, she kind of sweeps out the old from the fireplace and sweeps in the new. And so I think, although Hestia doesn't know this, I'm hoping that the reader comes to know that what she's looking for is some sense of home and some sense of what that hearth fire is. And I really struggled with what she wants too, because when I first started writing it, it was just a given, like, oh yeah, she's single, so now she wants to find someone. Mm-hmm. And because that's what you do, right? Like, you break up, you grieve for a little while, and then you start dating again. But when I was writing it, after a while, I thought, why do people want to date? I forgot, you know, like, I was so deep in writing it that I forgot why people want to date. And of course, when you're in your 20s, it's just like, man, you just want to find someone. That's just, you don't even need to think about it. It's such an atavistic urge to be partnered up with someone. But then as I was talking to friends in their 50s and 60s, and one of my friends who's 70, one of my friends in her 70s, who's been married twice, said, no, I think I've done my bit by the husbands of the world. I don't need to do this again.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So I, in addition to finding myself struggling with why do you want to pair up, Hestia was struggling with that too. And she did seek insight from other people in the book about why. And I just, you know, everybody has a different reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's just so many other tensions in the book to pull you through. And those, I never felt a lack of plot or a lack of something pulling me forward. It's just sort of interesting that when I finished reading it, that you sort of realized that it's something that you only come to realize how it worked afterwards, which is a cool thing. You mentioned this, the parents. And it is like the other, it's like the third piece of the, if there's three things, if it's the dating life and the relationship with the people and the retirement village, mm-hmm. the third thing is her relationship with her parents. And it is a really fraught, difficult one, because they find themselves not aligned with anybody, but they're a little bit more angry at liberal mind speak.
Yeah.
Can you talk about this difficult parental relationship and putting it at the forefront?
Yeah. So, you know, people have asked me, why did you make the parents college professors? You know, that's such an unusual background for someone who's leaving the Union for the Confederacy. It's like, well, I don't think it's that unusual. I mean, there's no monolithic Confederate or conservative mindset. There's a lot of different kinds of conservative people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked creating the parents because I got to think outside of stereotype of, you know, it's not, they're not the people wearing like the coonskin caps, and they're not the people, you know, wearing animal furs, or, you know, it's not that like MAGA crowd. It's people who are, her parents are intelligent people who are just, they're just offended by what the liberal ideology is asking of them. Mm-hmm. It's they feel like the liberal ideology has just gone a bit too far, and now they feel insulted and offended by that. And so I really wanted to be compassionate with them, as I think Hestia tries to be, or at least by the end of the book, she's feeling more compassionate toward them. Like, these are, you know, people who are aging, and, you know, they want to, they sort of estrange themselves from her in the beginning, but that relationship evolves too.
Right. Well, I mean, This was what was so heartbreaking to me reading it, was that they really wanted to connect, and they have this idea of who their daughter is still in their head. And it is it is not who she is anymore. And so I don't know. I was feeling that, but I was also just heartbroken when they kept having these interactions where everybody walked away like, well, that wasn't how I wanted that to go.
Right. Someone asked my editor, Jenna, what was the scene that you read that made you want the book?
Oh.
And I loved the answer she gave. Yeah, which was, she said, there's a scene toward the beginning when Hestia gets picked up from the train station by her mom, and they're driving to her parents' house. And they get there, and there's a big sign in the yard that says something like, make liberals cry again in the yard. And she sees this sign, and instead of saying anything about the sign, she says, your tulips look really nice, Mom. And apparently that scene really resonated for her. And I do think, and I have a lot of exchanges like that with my own parents, who are very conservative and live in Virginia outside of Richmond. And there just comes a point where you just can't talk about it anymore. You make a decision like, am I going to be with these people in my life or not? And if you are, then you got to skip to the next topic.
Yeah. I mean, something that your book makes clear, though, is how difficult that is, because everyone sort of goes into these interactions with that idea as a ground rule. But everything ends up, it's like I was saying, like everything ends up touching it, and you think it won't. You think you can keep something separate.
Yeah.
Oof. This book is super funny. I feel like we just talked about how difficult it is, but it really caught me by surprise over and over with how funny it is. And you recommended a book that also has an interesting parental relationship at the center. Is also a very archly funny, Good Behavior by Molly Keene. Can you tell me about why you suggested this book and how it came across your desk?
Yeah. Just a very dear friend here in Baltimore, also a writer, very arch, Jim Magruder, recommended this book to me. And I love his recommendations, which is why I read it. And it's just so delicious. Like, that's the way I describe the writing of Good Behavior. It is so delicious to have a character who reveals so much through her total lack of understanding of what's going on around her.
Mm-hmm. I was fascinated by the sort of background of this book. That was published when she was 77 years old in 1981.
Yeah.
She hadn't published a novel in 30 years.
Yeah.
And then this one was nominated for a Booker Prize, but she lost out to Salman Rushdie's Midnight Children, along with Muriel Spark and Doris Lessing. So that's, you know,
she was in good company.
Good loser company there.
Yes.
But a 30-year gap. It was enough for this book to be not connected to she wrote 10 other novels.
Right.
So there was just like, no one thought of her as the writer of those books. They were like, this is a completely new, I just can't imagine, like, and this sat in a drawer. She thought it was nasty. She told her friends not to read it.
She tried to sell this book and I think what the rejections said something about, it's too nasty. We can't do this. And then 30 years later, someone said, why don't you try again? And it worked, which, I love. And actually, you're right. When I think about that, a 30-year gap, like that's a young adult who's never heard of her before. And then suddenly there's this book to read. And it just, the era that it captures, I love that era of like, what is it, like crumbling aristocracy and all the horses and hounds and foxes.
I think my favorite thing was this sort of cliffside house this gothic manor that I just thought of as like leaking and falling apart, that they sort of retreat to, that was also apparently extremely based on her own life on the end of it.
Yes.
That sea house was based on some amount of reality. Yeah. But also, the center of this book is like skewering and laying bare at the same time the family's fall. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, and those details, they can be like excruciating and delicious too. But also, I mean, you just have to be up for reading about some rich people problems. You know, you really have to care about what he's doing with the horses. Which you know, your mileage may vary.
Yeah, it is sort of a White Lotus kind of novel, really. Like, just how tasty it is to read about rich people being utter assholes, right?
And truly, this writing, I mean, I was always thinking how she never goes for the cliche. She always turns a cliche or goes one further, something sharper than a cliche.
Yeah.
Where you actually kind of feel the lack. You know that there could have been a more stock phrase there, but she went somewhere else. And so you feel her like,
I know,
ducking and weaving.
I know. The sentence level writing in that novel is so amazing. I mean, there are just sentences that I wanted to read over and over again. You know, even something, my friend Jim, who recommended this, I found myself texting him lines from the book as I was reading.
Right, right.
Right. And there was this one line where I guess they had a lawyer who was always bringing the family woodcocks, mm-hmm. you know, which people would cook and eat. And there's this line where someone says, well, we should let the servant have it, and for father, because Rose knows how to cook his woodcock. She knows the right way to cook his woodcock. it's like lines like that said, delivered so deadpan, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you just deliver that line and you keep going. And it's the kind of book I felt like where sometimes you have to read it a few times, the lines. Yeah.
Yeah. This is sort of like quintessential NYRB release, like a sleeper thing that you, when you actually get into it, you realize there's so much to dig into.
Yeah. Well, and just that era that I didn't really know very much about, where you have all these British aristocrats living in Ireland in these big houses, but they're like slowly or maybe quickly losing all their wealth, spending right. themselves out of existence. And those big houses get really cold if you don't spend the money on heating them. Mm-hmm.
How does this, a book like that, you say you like to reread things, how does this book fit into your reading life, and what is your reading life these days?
I have a pretty, I think, fairly eclectic reading life lately. I recently read Heartburn by Nora Ephron for the first time, and was blown away because I don't know if you know this, but the movie was pretty terrible. But the book was so good. And it's been a while since I've read any Nora Ephron, but getting reacquainted with her, I just thought this is so sharp. Mm. But then on the other hand, I've recently read, I like nonfiction too. I really enjoyed Braiding Sweetgrass. That book? Yeah. I enjoyed that a lot. And I like books with kind of a science-y lean to them.
Well, I feel like we're moving straight into one of my favorite portions of the show, which is just recommendations. We're in it now.
Did I jump the gun?
No, it's okay. It's good. Okay. It seems like your writing about science background fuels this sort of interest. I think it's interesting that Hestia doesn't have that sort of science.
Yeah.
This seems like it was kept separate for you.
Yeah, it was. Hestia was kind of a different compartment for me, where I got to write about someone who doesn't know that much about science. And actually there were moments in the book where I had to intentionally make her less knowledgeable. Like, she doesn't know what kind of tree she's looking at,
right,
for example. And like, I know a lot of trees. I know what a lot of the trees are. So I would go back and say, no, she doesn't know that it's a sycamore. She has no idea.
Mm.
So that was kind of fun. But I got to investigate with this book something that I don't normally investigate, which is history. And that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy a daily newsletter by a historian and professor named Heather Cox Richardson. I think a lot of people have not heard of her, but she teaches history in, I believe it's Maine. And she does this daily newsletter that started during the Trump administration, where she would just sort of sum up all the news that happened that day. Like, here's what's important. Here's what's less important. Here's what it means. Here's where it fits into history. And I still get that newsletter. And I mean, and her perspective on what's happening now is very much informed by Civil War and Reconstruction, because I think that's her special thing.
That sounds like a great resource.
Yeah, it is a great resource. But I don't want to paint myself. I'm a dirty liberal fiction reader. Like, that's my main thing.
Right.
I mean, I buy the novels. So,
do you have any novel recommendations?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I'm reading Burnham Wood. I really enjoyed that. I recently read Liberation Day by George Saunders, which was which I love everything he writes. But I also recently read his nonfiction book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, which is where he takes a Chekhov story.
Each
chapter is a different Chekhov story, and he explains why it's so great.
That is a truly magical book, and it's actually what, when he came on this podcast, talked about. So if people want to go and check that out, it's a fun episode from a while back now.
And then if you like audiobooks, well, strangely, some of his books are not easy to listen to,
mm-hmm.
because so much of it is visual. I think you need to see it to understand it.
Right.
But Liberation Day, I thought, worked really well on audio, and they get these great actors to do the voices. They have Michael McKean and Tina Fey. And so it's really good.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. I read a really funny book called We All Want Impossible Things by Catherine Newman. It sounds sad because it's about a friend who's dying, but it was really, really good. I have read, I just love Sigrid Nunes. I read her books. I recently read The Friend, which I had put off for a long time because I've got the sense that it was about a dog. I was like, I don't want to read about a dog. Not reading about a dog. But then I finally did get it and realized it's not about a dog. It's about it's about writing. It's about the need and the difficulty of being a writer and friendship. And it was just, I love her.
That's a great book. I mean, I'm the opposite. I love any book about dogs. So any book that features an animal, actually, I want to recommend a book by Shelby Van Pelt, Remarkably Bright Creatures, and it's about a octopus in an aquarium and the sort of characters that are all connected to the octopus in various ways, but you're mostly following someone from the janitorial staff.
Oh, wow.
who is connected to, and you just follow, it's a very sweet, it feels sort of like reading an indie film. I could see this movie premiering at Sundance. But yeah, Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. I was totally taken aback. My mom actually recommended it to me, and it was a great recommendation.
Okay.
So thanks to my mom.
Yeah, thanks to Christopher's mom. I have become aware recently of octopuses or octopi, and how incredibly smart they are. And I'm a little sad about it because I do love to eat octopus. I don't think I can do that anymore.
I think that's the ultimate power move, is to go and take that book to a raw bar.
Yeah, let's see how that goes.
That is not part of my recommendation. Don't do that. But things that you should do is threefold. The first thing that you should absolutely do is go and support this show on Patreon, patreon.com/smdb. Even if you pay just a dollar, you can join in on all the fun, including a book club and special episodes that are just recorded for the Patreon patrons. Really fun stuff. Also, the second thing that you should do is rate the show on iTunes. I really like when that happens. It's good for the algorithm and good for the health of the show. And the third thing that you should absolutely do is to go buy Hestia Strikes a Match. It is such a great novel. Christine, thank you for hanging out with me. This has been a blast, and I'm so glad that you had the time.
Yeah, I am so grateful that you've invited me, and I am now halfway through with my bespoke bourbon drink, which is great.
Oh, my tea party redux is long gone, so now I'm feeling pretty good.
Well, I'm saving that recipe, and I'm looking up that George Saunders episode for sure.
Wonderful.